from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, NATO and U.S. officials are in Turkey for talks on the fight against Islamic State. A look at how terrorists recruit Muslim youth.
These groups are utilizing this failed state's lack of prospects for the future.
The Palestinian Authority holds its first unity cabinet meeting in Gaza. And the Hong Kong government calls off talks with protesters. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The NATO Secretary General and U.S. officials coordinating the fight against Islamic State forces are in Turkey, which is under increasing pressure to support the Syrian border city of Kobani that is under siege by the militants. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, Turkey says it cannot be expected to conduct a unilateral ground operation against the Islamic State group in Syria.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg is spending 2 days meeting with Turkey's political leadership. The talks come as the city of Kobani on Turkey's border is in danger of being taken over by Islamic State militants who've been battling Kurdish fighters for weeks. At a news conference with the Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Cavusoglu, Stoltenberg promised NATO would support Turkey should the Islamic State launch a direct attack against a NATO member.
NATO stands ready to support all allies in defending their security. For many decades, Turkey has been a steadfast ally, contributing to our collective defense and to the stability of the region.
But despite such assurances, Cavusoglu ruled out any unilateral military action in support of Kurdish fighters in Kobani. It's not realistic to expect that Turkey will lead a ground operation on its own, he said. When we reach a joint agreement, Turkey will do its utmost. But our strategy is to explain to our allies the reality on the ground. Cavusoglu said any intervention would have to be part of a broader military action to create a buffer zone in Syria and a no-fly zone to protect it. The Turkish foreign minister argued it's the Syrian regime of President Bashar al-Assad that remains the main threat to the region and not radical Islamic groups. The NATO Secretary General said the creation of safety zones in Syria was not at present on the alliance's agenda. The Turkish government is also currently refusing to open its bases for airstrikes against the militants. That stance, observers say, is causing concern and frustration in Washington. Retired General John Allen, the coordinator of the Anti-Islamic State Coalition, is leading a high-powered U.S. delegation, which is meeting with Turkey's leadership to discuss what exactly Turkey's contribution would be. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
While U.S.-led coalition forces continue to attack Islamic State and other Islamist militants in Syria and Iraq, some analysts say one of the key elements of beating IS is avoiding making new enemies among the warring parties and handing the group more allies. Heather Murdoch has details from Beirut.
One of the trickiest things for coalition forces fighting the Islamic State is determining which groups should be enemies and which should be allies. And it is allies, analysts say, that are important, not friends. Director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, Lina Khatib, says from the beginning, coalition forces made a mistake in targeting Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Nusra along with the Islamic State. Khatib says the group could be a short-term coalition ally because it is also a long-time enemy of Islamic State militants. And while al-Nusra is technically also fighting the so-called moderate rebel groups, they do also have a relationship that Khatib calls backdoor connections. But for the West and in Lebanon, where al-Nusra forces continue to attack the borders, the idea of working with al-Nusra is impossible for the public to swallow, says the director of American Strategic Studies in Beirut, Kamal Wazni.
It's been identified as a terrorist organization, and it's part of the havoc that is taking place in the Middle East. We have to remember those people committed a lot of murder, a lot of destruction, a lot of car bombings, a lot of suicide attacks. So do we really trust them?
But as airstrikes continue and civilian casualty numbers mount, International Crisis Group Acting Program Director for the Middle East and North Africa, Robert Bletcher, says the coalition's options for friends on the ground will quickly diminish. During air campaigns in countries like Pakistan and Yemen, he says, new enemies were created every time a bomb hit a village or a wedding party.
Can anybody name a sustained air campaign that has not generated considerable civilian casualties in a way that complicated the mission. I can't think of any examples.
The complications, he mentions, could be considerable in Syria, which is already embroiled in a complex civil war. Besides anger over civilian deaths, coalition airstrikes are essentially boosting the government of President Bashar Assad. And the main enemy of the rebel groups the coalition is counting on for ground support is the Assad regime.
You're creating a situation where it's very difficult for the mainstream rebels to not come out against these strikes, and they end up getting pushed away from the main people. Rebels end up getting pushed away from the mainstream groups toward the more radical groups, because it looks like the U.S. is acting on behalf of the regime.
Bletcher says if they do not support the coalition, the mainstream rebel groups will most likely not back the extremists, but they will be on the same side. Establishing strong allies is also made difficult by long-term animosity among locals towards the West in Syria and Iraq, he says. To justify allying with the United States and the West, Bletcher says fighters ideologically opposed to Islamic State extremism will need concrete and sustained support. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Beirut.
A new report examines why some Muslim youth are turning to terrorism. FinChurch Aid examined the situations in Somalia and Kenya, came to several conclusions, and is offering solutions to countering radicalization. We asked Antin Pintakanen, executive director of the group, what they learned.
That actually we didn't know the facts very well. And I think this is the biggest lessons learned, that we should never expect that we know the facts before we have really done the research. And it was surprisingly to see how different the same group is looking from Somalia than looking from Kenya. In Somalia, the economic factor was much bigger, and the group we interviewed, which is about 100 former Al-Shabaab fighters, could not be considered more radical than the general public. However, in Kenya, there was a big grievances towards government and more religious reasoning on it. So in order to counter violent extremism and deal with de-radicalization, you really have to know the drivers in order to address them properly in your programs.
Why are these youths becoming terrorists? Why are they being converted?
Hugely, these vulnerable societies are very much exposed to groups with different agendas. They've really lost often the hope in life. So these groups are utilizing this failed state's lack of prospects for the future. In Somalia, basically, if the youth would have jobs, if they would have employment opportunities, they would go into these groups. In Kenya, I think the government has to review how they are dealing with the Muslim community. Currently, they're alienating pretty much them and feeling them to be under pressure and under attack. So in those contexts, you have to be more nuanced and have better proper dialogue with these communities to understand what they want.
Can you take this a step further for us, please, and maybe apply it to what's going on in Syria and Iraq right now with ISIS?
Certainly. I think still we would need to make some research there with the actual fighters to really understand their processes. But I think the key lesson learned here is that the world really doesn't understand this recruitment properly enough in order to address it. So even whatever campaigns are launched and policies put in place, the recruitment is still going on. And so if you don't address the recruitment issue properly, you will not become successful. And the big risk with this current campaign in Iraq and Syria is that a lot of these people that are fighting there will go back to their home countries, and the front towards the caliphate will only expand to 15, 20 other countries.
The world is an awful big place, and there's an awful lot of people without jobs, a lot of poverty, a lot of suffering in the world. How can the international community be expected to even attempt to handle this situation?
Well, the key in our experience is that the local populations have to believe in a better future. And they often have local disputes and local problems that has have not been resolved. So the political framework set up, whether it's Syria, Iraq, Mali, Libya, have to include space for the local communities to come up with their own solutions. However, if the policy framework doesn't allow that, you actually expose these local communities to radical groups who don't care, who won't actually utilize these situations. That's number one. Number two is that these movements are kind of postmodern religious groups that oppose and actually assassinate and kill traditional religious leaders. And so you have to appreciate and support the role of these movements, the religious leaders and themselves, to give the motivation for the people for a better future. So it needs a multiple ways of giving space for a local initiative. If you only commit with the security lens and counterterrorism lens, you are very likely going to reduce the space of these indigenous traditional structures. So this requires a lot of policy review in the capitals in UN.
And what about within the Muslim community and within the religious community?
Absolutely. The problem, however, is that these kids, whether they come from West or Somalia, don't discuss these issues with the religious leaders. Yes, you have clerics here and there doing recruitment, but mainly it's not an issue of the organized Muslim communities. So these kids need to be given space where they more openly share these issues, and certainly you have to sensitize the communities to address what these groups are telling the kids and showing based on their tradition what their true understanding of their faith is.
Antti Pentikäinen, executive director of Finn Church Aid, based in Geneva. As the battle against Islamic State unfolds, many nations are increasingly worried about casualties closer to home. Hundreds of young Europeans and others have joined the jihad fight in the Middle East. Experts estimate up to 10% of them are women, seduced by an idealized version of a true Islamic state and the combat to achieve it. Lisa Bryant looks at the phenomenon from France, leading exporter of female recruits.
Weeks ago, Asia Saidi disappeared from her home in southern France, leaving the reason on a Facebook page, off to join the jihad in Syria. Investigators and her panicked family launched a massive search, and last Saturday, they found the 15-year-old working at a Marseille bar. Asia told French radio she'd been tempted by the jihad through the web. But in Marseille, people told her the recruiters were terrorists. There are plenty of less happy endings. Hundreds of girls and young women are leaving Western nations to join the Islamic State and other radical groups. It's hard to say how many, but France appears to be a leading exporter. Out of nearly 1,000 jihadi recruits from here, more than 60 are female. Lecturer Catherine Brown of the Defense Studies Department at King College London has been analyzing women's role in jihadi movements.
This idea of radicalization is very, very popular at the moment, but actually our understanding of it is very limited, because what's become really, really clear is that individual motives are very, very diverse.
Brown has analyzed social media sites to find out why Western women are signing up.
Women join radical groups and travel to Islamic State for both personal and political reasons. I really resist this idea of saying it's all about, you know, emotion, or it's all about finding a husband, or it's all impulsive or irrational.
She says some do head out to become so-called jihadi brides, but others are drawn by the vision of a utopian Muslim nation, the one IS is trying to sell despite its brutal methods. French anthropologist Donia Bouzard heads a new Paris center to prevent radicalization. She says men are captivated by more classical arguments of fighting evil. Recruiters use humanitarian arguments to lure women.
Puisque les filles, les groupuscules, les persuadent qu'elles vont faire de l'humanitaire.
Bouzard says the first method of indoctrination by recruiters is to persuade women they must die in the Holy Land to save those they love. The second is the need for humanitarian work there, drawing lots of women who want to get into medicine, nursing, social work, altruistic jobs. But IS is also sending a more activist message, says Islamist expert and former senior counterterrorism official Louis Caprioli.
L'État islamique a fait un changement complet c'est eux-mêmes qui valorisent le rôle de la femme.
He says IS supports the idea of women not just going out to do social work, but actually playing a role. He says videos show women using tough language, saying they're going out to kill people and holding a Kalashnikov. These images have a big impact, Brown says, even if very few women actually head out to battle.
And the reason it's significant is because of our biases, because it's powerful in our society to see women engaging in acts of violence. So it's quite it's a propaganda coup.
Some recruits may be Muslims who feel rejected by European society, but 17-year-old Hélène grew up in an atheist household in the Paris suburbs, converting to Islam 2 years ago. France's Le Monde newspaper recounts how she watched videos of a Kuwaiti preacher and had an Egyptian boyfriend who promised to take her to a country that respected Sharia law. In reality, Bouzard says, these young women have only a sketchy notion of the Islamic faith.
Les trois quarts des jeunes dont je vous parle n'ont jamais mis les pieds dans une mosquée. Et par exemple, le mardi, elles mangent du porc.
Bouzard says three quarters of these young women have never even put their foot in a mosque. On Tuesday, they can be eating pork, and on Wednesday, they could be ready to go to Syria. The religious question is never pushed during indoctrination, she says, only at the end. Expert Caprioli says young Catholics are also attracted by militant Islam.
Elle découvre à travers l'islam une rigueur que le catholicisme n'a pas.
In Islam, Caprioli says they find a certain rigor that Catholicism doesn't have. They believe Islam is more respectful of women because they live in a Western society where women are aggressed and raped. So they idealize the position of women in Islam, thinking they don't submit to this kind of violence. The reality, of course, is different. A UN report describes massive atrocities by Islamic State militants against women in Iraq, including killing and sexual slavery. Researcher Brown says these Western jihadis get another less gruesome reality check.
And what we're tending to see again is actually life is quite a lot harsher than they imagined. So there are tweets about, you know, where can I find a hairdryer? The fact that toilets are communal, things like that I don't think they'd particularly thought about before they left.
Once there, some are trapped. That's the case of 16-year-old Noura El Bati from the French city of Avignon. In May, her brother Fouad managed to visit her in Syria. He described to local media his unsuccessful efforts to bring her home and how Noura had told him that she had made the mistake of her life. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority is on a two-day reconciliation visit to Hamas-controlled Gaza to assess the destruction caused by the recent conflict with Israel. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian Authority Prime Minister Rami Hamdallah presided in Gaza over the first cabinet meeting of his unity government since the conflict 7 years ago between the Fatah movement that dominates the authority and the Hamas group that controls Gaza. Mr. Hamdallah and his delegation from the West Bank visited several neighborhoods that were severely damaged by the 50-day conflict in July and August between Israel and Hamas-led militants in Gaza. He said the huge destruction and human suffering in Gaza reminds Palestinian leaders of their responsibilities and obliges them to end their split and start reconstruction. The first mission, he concluded, is to bring Gaza back to normal and back to unity with the West Bank. The Hamas spokesman said in a statement that the group welcomed the visit. Mr. Hamdallah heads a unity government of technocrats that was formed as part of a reconciliation agreement between Fatah and Hamas. The two-year-old accord is aimed at ending the rift between the two groups that opened after Hamas seized control of Gaza 7 years ago. Under the accord, the Palestinian Authority is to assume control over reconstruction efforts in Gaza. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas announced the unity government 4 months ago after a U.S.-led effort to revive the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks collapsed. The announcement angered the Israeli government and contributed to rising tensions that erupted in the 50-day conflict in which 2,100 Palestinians and 72 Israelis were killed. Palestinian officials say the conflict caused more than $7 billion worth of damage to infrastructure, housing, and businesses. They are seeking $4 billion in aid at a donors' conference that is scheduled to convene Sunday in Cairo. Ministers from some 30 countries are to attend, as well as senior officials from the European Union and United States. Mr. Hamdallah plans to leave Gaza Friday after meetings with local businessmen and more visits to damaged neighborhoods in the enclave. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
The Hong Kong government has called off talks with student protesters that were meant to ease tensions after weeks of pro-democracy protests in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory. Chief Secretary Carrie Lam told reporters today that the protesters' call for expansion of the movement has shaken the trust of the government and made productive talks impossible. The talks had been set for Friday. Lam said the government does not want to be linked with possibly illegal actions. Earlier today at a news conference, a group of student leaders said they will not disperse the sit-ins that have paralyzed parts of the city for nearly 2 weeks. Reporter Daniel Sharp has details.
Well, basically, they announced that they're going to continue their campaign of civil disobedience, of occupying several different parts of the central area of Hong Kong, blocking off the streets, barricading them from any government traffic in a show of defiance against the Hong Kong government, the chief executive of which they want to step down. And they want to see the constitution reformed so that Beijing has no influence over choosing who is elected leader of Hong Kong.
This is causing some economic problems for businesses in Hong Kong, and you've been covering that story, the clogging of streets. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, that's one thing that we are seeing is there are a growing number of voices that are upset with the blocking off of streets. It's causing some disruption to business. Not only is the traffic down, but people who are concerned about the situation, about the possibility of there being safety problems, are staying away from the area. So some businesses have suffered. Other businesses seem to be doing okay, and some that we talked to indicated that they haven't been affected much at all. So it's a bit of a mixed picture, but overall, of course, this is going to have an impact on Hong Kong's economy because there is very little traffic in these very central areas. So deliveries and people going to work, they all have to slow down, and they have to go through certain rerouted areas. So it is causing some concern that we're going to see an economic impact from the protests.
Now, is there any sense that the local Hong Kong government can really do anything for these demonstrators? I mean, isn't everything in the hands of the people of China?
Well, that's part of the problem, is that the Hong Kong government, although Hong Kong does have its own constitution under what's known as the Basic Law, there is a lot of influence among the politicians here by Beijing. And there's a lot of concern in China that if the leader of Hong Kong is truly elected by the people, that leader may not be willing to play ball with Beijing, that there could be confrontations between the Hong Kong leadership and Beijing. And that's something that they don't want to see in China. They don't want people in the mainland knowing that their leaders can be elected and can actually challenge the authority of the Chinese Communist Party. So this is part of the fear that they don't want to allow truly direct elections. And that's why we saw in August Beijing's parliament declaring, the national parliament in Beijing declaring that they would be selecting which candidates would be allowed to stand for office here in Hong Kong. And that's what sparked these protests. And that's why we're not seeing the students wanting to back down. They feel like this is a fundamental aspect of democracy, that they be allowed to choose their leaders, that they not be hand-selected by the government in Beijing.
Reporter Daniel Sharp speaking with us from Hong Kong. Attempts to force Hong Kong Chief Executive Leung Chun-ying to resign may be bolstered by the recent emergence of media reports accusing the leader of taking $6.4 million in undisclosed payments from an Australian company while in office. Ling has denied any wrongdoing in accepting the payments. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.